So apparently there's a rematch clause in place for this Joe Joyce Joseph Parker fight, and it seems as though it was Team Joyce who insisted upon it. Now, if the rematch takes place, then it will be on Sky Box Office. This was confirmed by Joseph Parker's promoter, Ben Shalom. And Joseph Parker and Ben Shalom in an interview were making out as though they didn't need a rematch clause in place. They were perfectly confident having a one-fight deal. In fact, Joseph Parker talked about that regarding his handshake with Frank Warren, that it would be a one-fight deal. And Frank Warren wanted a three-fight deal or whatever the case may be. And in fact, Frank Warren has kind of admitted that he wanted a multi-fight deal with Joseph Parker. In any event, does this suggest that Team Parker are actually more confident than Team Joyce if they were willing to have a one-fight deal, whereas Team Joyce basically want to fight twice, or they want the option to fight twice? And with Frank Warren, it would have been thrice, right? I mean, I don't know if it would be three fights against Joyce, potentially two fights against Joyce and another fight against somebody else. But as I say, does that mean that Team Parker are more confident? Now, stylistically, you can see how Joseph Parker could be a nightmare for Joe Joyce, because he's fast, he's athletic, he's got quick hands, he's got quick feet. And for the most part, Joseph Parker doesn't get hit that much. He's relatively good at staying out of the way. Yeah, he got dropped by Derek Chisora and Dylan White, but against Anthony Joshua, he managed to stay out of the way. Against Andy Ruiz, he, for the most part, managed to stay out of the way. So his defense isn't bad. And of course, in the Derek Chisora rematch, he managed to stay out of the way as well while doing plenty of damage to Del Boy. So a guy with those kind of abilities, right, the fast hands, fast feet, relatively good defensively, you can see how that might be tough for Joe Joyce to contend with. Now, Joyce does have the ability to box behind a jab. We saw that against Daniel Dubois, but Daniel Dubois is nowhere near as fast or fleet of foot as Joseph Parker. So whether the tactics he used against Dubois would work against Parker remains to be seen. I suspect it wouldn't be quite that simple. But surely Joe Joyce and his team, Ismael Salas, will look at the Anthony Joshua-Joseph Parker fight and maybe try and emulate what Anthony Joshua did there again. That was similar tactics to the ones Joe Joyce employed against Dubois. But again, remains to be seen if that works. Let me know what you guys think in the comments below. What tactics should Joe Joyce employ here against Joseph Parker? And also, what do you think about there being a rematch clause in the contract and Team Joyce apparently being insistent upon it? Was it even Joyce who insisted upon the rematch clause, or was it actually Frank Warren? Maybe Joyce was happy to go ahead with a one-fight deal. I don't know. But Warren, of course, is trying to not only get content for his broadcaster, but also add some level of security for himself in case his guy loses. So yeah, let me know what you guys think of that. And in terms of rematches in general, look, Dylan White had a rematch clause in place when he fought Alexander Povetkin. He could have just waited for his shot, but he decided to continue fighting these dangerous opponents. He gets knocked out by Povetkin first time, has a rematch clause in the contract, gets to run it back immediately afterwards. I understand why fighters and promoters do it, but from a fan perspective, it holds up the division. There are lots of fights which could have happened but didn't because of rematch clauses. I mean, Tyson Fury, my real bugbear, my real gripe is when mandatory challengers agree to sign a contract with a rematch clause in it. I don't understand that. People talk about, oh yeah, they get extra money and all this kind of stuff. But again, from a fan perspective, it's holding up the division, and the mandatory challenger doesn't have to do it. So Tyson Fury signed a rematch clause for Klitschko. Imagine if he hadn't. He might have got a defense in before that UCAD situation. Same with, let me think now. Well, Anthony Joshua against Alexander Usyk. Usyk decided to sign a rematch clause, and that's why we're getting the Usyk fight again. If that rematch clause wasn't signed by Usyk, if that wasn't in the contract, then perhaps we'd be getting the Undisputed fight or Usyk against somebody else. Do you know what I mean? The only mandatory in recent memory, in the heavyweight division at least, that didn't have a rematch clause in a contract was Tyson Fury against Dylan White. Dylan White, you know, obviously we know what happened in that fight, but he didn't want to do what Tyson Fury did, what Usyk did, and so on. If he won, he wanted to be able to sail off into the sunset. And I would hope that more mandatory challenges decide to go down that road in future, because it gives us a break from the incessant rematch clauses, involuntary defenses, and now even between two contenders like Dillon White and Povetkin, or here with Joe Joyce and Joseph Parker, constant rematch clauses. Can we not move on and have the rematch somewhere down the line and see these guys against different fighters, you know? So anyway, rant over. You guys let me know what you think in the comment section below. I just want to expand on some things I said in a recent video about psychopathy and address a couple of questions and comments. Now, as usual, there were a small number of people making condescending or passive-aggressive remarks, and obviously they just get blocked and deleted. If you can't address the topic in a civil and respectful manner, and you're coming straight out with all these snarky remarks, then I've got to get you out of here. And then you get these people who wrongly assume that just because I have a boxing channel, the only thing in the world that I have any degree of knowledge or understanding of is boxing. They don't know me or know anything about me, but they make this bizarre and baseless assumption that I've never studied anything else in my entire life other than boxing. And again, those people get blocked as well. The reality is, I've studied a variety of things and have obtained a good deal of knowledge and understanding about multiple subjects. Some people are intimidated by this, of course. It makes them feel desperately insecure. So you get all the stick to boxing comments, which is another instant block. There was some guy on a recent video who said, it's funny how Hatman's talking about VPNs when he has no idea how they work. Well, I'm not a tech guy, and I've never claimed to be. I've never studied tech in any great depth, and my knowledge of it is very limited. But what I do know is I can use a VPN to circumvent regional blocks on YouTube videos, because I've been doing it for years. I also know that certain websites are inaccessible when my VPN is turned on. So obviously, technology exists that can block VPN users. And in the video, I said that I hope YouTube don't have the means or the desire to implement such technology for the Joshua Usyk rematch. That's literally all I said. But this weirdo felt the need to try and ridicule me for saying that. But as I said, these people are just desperately insecure attention seekers who are bitter and envious. Sad stuff. And the bad news is, your life's only going to get worse. So seek help. Anyway, in the video about the Daniel Dubois, Don King situation, I mentioned the fact that there are many forensic psychologists, including Dr. Robert Hare, who are of the view that psychopaths are born, they're not made. And this is a view that I concur with. But I also mentioned the fact that there are other people who some refer to as proto-psychopaths. These are individuals who develop psychopathic behavior due to environmental factors, childhood trauma, and so on. The distinction being that a proto-psychopath is not a true psychopath. Therefore, in many instances, they can be successfully treated. Whereas with a pure or true psychopath, i.e. someone who was born that way, their condition is untreatable. In fact, Robert Hare and many other experts in the field will tell you that when you attempt to treat a psychopath, it actually makes them worse. Now, there was someone in the comments who was very civil and respectful, who said that he didn't think that the science was settled on psychopathy regarding nature versus nurture. And he's absolutely correct. The science isn't settled. There are psychologists who disagree with Dr. Robert Hare and his colleagues. So it's an ongoing debate. All I was saying is that based upon my research, I tend to think that Dr. Robert Hare is right. But on a side note, the whole concept of settled science, quote unquote, is unscientific in itself. Real science is never settled. It's a process of ongoing inquiry where all theories and paradigms are scrutinized in perpetuity. Settled science leads to dogma and stagnation, in which case it isn't really science at all. This settled science idea is often pushed by corporate and political entities in order to further their various agendas. If you've got billions of dollars to fund research or defund scientific research, then obviously you've got a big influence over what the scientific consensus is on certain issues. This is why a truly intelligent person will never take the consensus at face value. They'll do their own independent research. Now, of course, there will be many instances in which the consensus turns out to be correct, but there will also be many instances where the consensus is incorrect. The bottom line is, do your own research. Don't outsource your critical thinking to other people. Only sheep do that. You gotta be like a judge in court. A judge is not a medical doctor or an engineer or a scientist. But what he is, or what he's supposed to be, is someone who has enough intelligence and enough discernment to decide whether the prosecution's doctor is talking more sense or is more credible than the defense's doctor. Anyone who tries to dissuade you from thinking for yourself or even ridicules you for doing so is coming from a place of deep insecurity. So don't entertain these people. Anyway, getting back on topic. Whenever I talk about psychopathy, I always get people asking me whether I think various different people are psychopaths. For example, on the last video, one person asked whether I thought Eddie Hearn and Al Haymon were psychopaths. Well, psychopath is not a term that I just throw around willy-nilly. I don't know anywhere near enough about Eddie Hearn, personally or professionally, to tell you whether or not he's a psychopath. And Al Haymon has never even done an interview, as far as I'm aware. So it should be obvious that it's completely impossible for me to say whether or not he's a psychopath either. In over 12 years on YouTube, there's only one person in boxing who I've ever called a psychopath, and that's Don King. And that's not because he's the only one in boxing, nor is it because he's the most extreme psychopath in boxing necessarily. It's simply because he's the only person in boxing who I know enough about and who has exhibited enough classic psychopathic behavior over a number of decades for me to feel confident enough to come to that conclusion. And in no way am I trying to present this as a clinical diagnosis. This is just my opinion, but it's an opinion based on many years of research, observation, analysis, etc. I studied psychology in college back in the 1990s, and I've continued to study it for many years since as a subject of personal interest. I've read loads of books, watched many documentaries, and so on. I'm not a professional psychologist. I don't have a PhD in the subject, but I don't need one in order to have an informed opinion. Sigmund Freud, one of the most influential figures in the field, had no formal qualifications in psychology at all. The same goes for his nephew, Edward Bernays, who also had a tremendous understanding of human psychology and used it to mastermind advertising and propaganda campaigns for various public figures, corporations, and even governments. And again, he had no formal qualifications in the field. Now, I'm not comparing myself to Freud or Bernays here, but my point is, you don't need to be a PhD in order to have an informed opinion on any given subject or even be an expert on it. Just look at Jack Parsons in rocketry, right? Again, these are extreme examples, but I'm just using them to emphasize my point. Now, as far as boxing goes, Cus D'Amato, the famous trainer, for my money, was an expert in boxing psychology. And again, he had no formal qualifications in psychology, but he read a lot about psychology, I believe, and he had a certain aptitude for it. And when you combine that with his life experience, his experience as an amateur boxer and as a boxing coach, this allowed him to develop certain techniques to fortify the minds of his fighters. I seriously doubt that the average graduate coming out of uni with a 2-1 in sports psychology would be anywhere near as adept to understanding the mind of a fighter and training the mind of a fighter as Cus D'Amato was, because there's no substitute for experience and there's no substitute for aptitude either. Some people just have a natural talent for things, including psychology. Many psychopaths, in fact, develop a very good understanding of human psychology. Beyond that, of the average person. This is what allows them to become so adept at manipulating people. Now, I'm generalizing here because not all psychopaths are equally adept, nor are they equally intelligent. But there are very few things more dangerous than an intelligent, academically qualified psychopath. Just think Harold Shipman, for example. And he only got caught because he got sloppy. How many Harold Shipmans didn't get caught? How many Harold Shipmans are there right now flying under the radar? You can never know. There was someone who left a comment that said that the ruling class contains a disproportionately large number of psychopaths. So they try and get academia to focus on psychopaths much lower down the socioeconomic ladder, like drug dealers and gang members, etc. I thought that was a very astute point. But back to my original point, psychopaths generally have a good understanding of human psychology. In fact, you may not be consciously aware of it, but everybody studies psychology. Every single one of you. When someone gets dumped by their partner, or loses someone close to them, or suffers some other type of tragedy, you know they're likely to be thinking in a particular way and feeling certain emotions, and that their behavior may change accordingly. And the same applies if someone has experienced something positive, which they're very happy and excited about. Another example would be if someone's having their first ever boxing match. You understand through personal experience or observation that the person is likely to be feeling a certain amount of nerves or fear as a result of having doubts in their mind, being concerned about getting humiliated in front of a crowd of people, etc. So everyone is constantly studying human psychology. Again, either consciously or subconsciously. We all have to understand psychology to a certain level in order to function normally in society. And as I said, psychopaths often have a better understanding of the human mind than most people, including many qualified people. In fact, in Dr. Robert Hare's book, Without Conscience, he details several instances where he got bamboozled and outsmarted by a psychopath. And this is a psychopath who had no formal training or qualifications in psychology at all, but he managed to outsmart and manipulate a professional psychologist. And Robert Hare said that most of his colleagues have experienced the same thing. They've all at some point in their careers been taken in by a psychopath at least once. Now, back to boxing. Tyson Fury is a guy who understands psychology quite well, and he's very manipulative too. Now, I'm not saying that he's a psychopath, not at all. I'm definitely not saying that he's a psychopath, but he has a better understanding of human psychology than most people, especially in a boxing context. In fact, sports psychologists actually study people like Tyson Fury and other elite sportsmen in order to learn what it is about their psychological makeup that makes them so good. So you've got sportsmen enlightening the psychologists about certain things. Now, generally, I've found that introspective people tend to understand psychology better than extrospective people. Just look at Carl Jung, for example. He was extremely introspective. That is how he developed such an advanced understanding of the human mind, not just from studying the minds of other people, but from constantly studying his own mind and his own behavior. Why do I think this way? Why do I have this fear or this desire or this prejudice or this ambition? Why did I react this way in that particular situation? Why did this other person react differently to me? What impact is this book or this film or this advert having on my psychological state? This is what is constantly going on in the minds of introspective people. And this process makes them more aware of the internal and external factors which color their perceptions and influence their behavior. And therefore, they can more easily see the things that influence other people's perceptions and behavior as well. Now, Sigmund Freud is another person whose work I rate highly, but he's fallen out of favor in many Western academic circles. His work is still held in very high regard in many places elsewhere in the world, but in the West, he's no longer flavor of the month and hasn't been for quite some time. Now, I definitely don't think that Freud was right about everything, obviously, but I think the reason he's being somewhat marginalized in the West is more to do with the fact that many of his views are incompatible with certain socio-political agendas that are being pushed in the West today. In other words, some of his views are incongruent with the political correctness which permeates modern academia. Anyway, I'll end it there. I talk a lot more about psychology and psychopathy on my Patreon. I've got a whole series on serial killers. I recently did a 2-part episode on Jimmy Savile. So if you're interested, sign up there. Otherwise, catch you guys on the next video. I'm out. A lot of people are talking about this picture with Deontay Wilder and Michael Hunter. It was posted to Hunter's Instagram, I believe. And the topic of discussion is Deontay Wilder's weight. They're saying he looks extremely skinny. They're wondering what happened, why he's lost all this weight since the third Tyson Fury fight. What's going on here? Well, I don't think it's anything particularly unusual because Deontay Wilder weighed in at a career heaviest for the Tyson Fury trilogy fight. 238 pounds? Let me just check here. Yeah, 238 against Tyson Fury. That is way above Deontay Wilder's natural weight, his walking around weight, when he's not pushing loads of weights in the gym. Because that's clearly what he was doing, and he posted videos of him doing it. That's clearly what he was doing in the, 18 months between the second and the third. In fact, even going into the second fight, he'd been pushing a load of weights. He continued it after the second fight. So he's pushing all these weights. He's angry. He's training really hard because he wants to right the wrong. He's drinking all the protein shakes and eating however many times a day. And he manages to come in at 238. His natural weight is probably 212, 213. He has bulked up an enormous amount. And the thing is, when you're naturally very skinny, like Deontay Wilder, once you stop all that intense weightlifting and protein shakes and all that, you're going to shrink right back down to your natural size. And that's all that's happened here, as far as I can tell. He's just shrunk back down to his natural size. Now, if we look at Deontay Wilder's weight here, 238 for the Fury trilogy fight. That was his career heaviest. Prior to that, 231 in the second Fury fight, 219 against Luis Ortiz, 223 against Brazil, 212 in the first Tyson Fury fight, 212 pounds. That is Deontay Wilder's natural weight. That's how small he is. 214 against Luis Ortiz. All right, 220 against Berman Stiverne in the rematch, 222 against Washington. So I would say Wilder's natural weight range is probably, you know, when he's not pumping loads of weights, his natural weight range is probably between 212 and about 222. Right? He's a skinny guy. Maybe he does a bit of strength and conditioning in one camp and a bit more in another camp. You know, a guy who's 6'7", who's got that kind of frame, it's a reasonable fluctuation, all right? But when you're talking about a guy coming in at 238 and his natural weight is 212, he is carrying an enormous amount of muscle, which his body wasn't genetically designed to carry. Therefore, it puts a strain on his cardiovascular system, the type of strain, again, that his cardiovascular system wasn't designed to deal with. So that's why, in my view, Deontay Wilder gassed out so badly, both in the second and in the third Tyson Fury fights. He was going for strength, particularly in the third fight, and he did seem to have some extra strength for a couple rounds. But that dissipated real quick, because again, he's not designed for 238 pounds of muscle. I always figured that he's better off coming in, you know, 220 at the absolute maximum against Tyson Fury in the, well, second and third fights. In the first fight, that's the best that Deontay Wilder ever did against Tyson Fury. Now, you could say that Fury was weakened and he didn't fight as aggressively in that fight as he did in the second and third fights. Granted, that's true. But I feel as though Deontay Wilder just had way more energy. And even if Tyson Fury had applied pressure, Wilder would have had a bit more in the tank because he isn't carrying around all this extra bulk. Just my view. Okay, now, whenever I talk about weightlifting and how detrimental packing on loads of muscle can be for a boxer, I always get these muscle heads turn up in the comments saying, oh, that man talking about weightlifting again, because I know for these guys, it's a lifestyle and they love it and they're obsessed with, you know, sculpting their body and all this kind of thing. And they want to believe that they are the absolute pinnacle of athletic prowess. You know, that's what these guys want to believe. But the reality is, for boxing, it's normally detrimental when you start packing on loads of muscle. If it's a little, again, it all depends on how big you are. And I can't say that it's going to be detrimental for every single fighter. There might be the odd anomaly where it actually works for them. But for the most part, in my experience, you might gain a certain amount of, I don't know, extra strength, extra power in some instances, if you've got the technique to actually be able to have that. But any benefits that you get from packing on loads of muscle will tend to be outweighed by the negatives, by lack of stamina, stiffness, etc. And to emphasize the point, Andre Ward recently came out and said that he feels that Anthony Joshua would be better off if he cuts down the muscle mass. So he said here, man, I've been trying to tell Anthony Joshua for the past 6 or 7 years, get the mass off. Then you'll feel faster, you'll want to throw more punches, and you won't hit that wall midway in the fight where that blood fills up in your muscles and you can't get the shots off. Okay, well, Andre Ward clearly doesn't know what he's talking about, does he? Well, I'm being sarcastic. Yes, he knows what he's talking about. The same goes for Manny Stewart, who really wasn't a fan of fighters packing on loads of muscle and, you know, hitting the weights bench. He wasn't a fan of that. What, does he not know what he's talking about? Does Ward not know what he's talking about? I think Teddy Atlas has said something similar for boxing. Now, with MMA, I've heard that it's a bit different, that sometimes the weightlifting can help more in MMA because of all the grappling and whatnot. I don't know about that, okay? I'm not an MMA guy like that. I watch MMA casually, yeah? I'm not a hardcore MMA guy. I'm a hardcore boxing guy. But with regards to boxing, you know, it's not some type of witch hunt against weightlifting that I'm launching for boxing here. Sometimes the muscle heads in the comments take it personally. Oh, that man, you're always having a go at weightlifters and blah, blah, blah. No, I just want to see fighters make the most out of their ability for my entertainment. Do you know what I mean? I want to see the absolute pinnacle of their ability. And I think that most fighters are only going to achieve that when they are fighting at or close to their natural weight. Not when they're packing on 10, 20, 30 pounds of muscle like Wilder did for the Tyson Fury trilogy fight. So anyway, I'll leave it there. Let me know what you guys think in the comments below about Deontay Wilder's weight. I hope if he comes back, that he comes back like this, skinny, like a beanpole. I think that particularly as he gets older, right, the stamina is not going to be the same as you get older, irrespective of how much weights you are or aren't doing. But I think it's going to be beneficial. You know, he's 36 now. It's going to be beneficial. He comes back close to his natural weight and he'll be faster and he needs to be strategic. That's the thing. All this coming out with rage and looking to knock people's heads off, I think he should use his back foot a little more and really kind of try to use his awkwardness. That's something he didn't do against Tyson Fury. There are fighters who have had success against Fury being awkward, you know, walking Fury onto shots. And I'm not saying that Deontay Wilder is going to fight Tyson Fury again. I wouldn't want to see that, certainly not at this stage. And I certainly would never pick him over Fury. But against other fighters in the division, other big men who might look at the Fury fights and say, okay, that's the blueprint of how to beat Wilder. Against those guys, I'd like to see Deontay Wilder develop a little bit more savvy, you know, be a bit more crafty. Instead of trying to meet fire with fire, move around the ring a bit. I mentioned in a video about Wilder several months ago, Devaro Williamson. Now, he wasn't necessarily as good as Wilder. He didn't achieve as much as Wilder achieved. But he was a similar build. He fought Vladimir Klitschko, actually dropped Klitschko. And he was crafty with it. Skinny guy, move around, wait for you to overextend, lunge him with a shot because you're getting frustrated by him constantly moving. And then bang, he nails you with a shot. That's how he dropped Vladimir Klitschko. You go watch that fight. Anyway, I'll leave it there. Let me know what you guys think in the comment section below.